Thank you very much. My name is T.R. Rice, and I represent the festival. From a factual standpoint, there's at least four things that are expressly clear in this case based upon the record. First, that Parsons was retained by the town as an independent contractor. Second, that Parsons counseled the town and owed a duty to the festival. Third, that Parsons made substantial errors in judgment in performing its tasks. And fourth, that the festival was impacted by those errors. Implicitly clear from the record comes from Judge Curry's denial of the request for attorney's fees that the festival made pursuant to Rule 11 and 1317.102, and that denial is, in effect, an indictment of Parsons. The basis for that is that Parsons was hired by the town to assist in its decision-making. The town reasonably relied upon Parsons. Parsons was in substantial error, and therefore the town should not be to blame. The record in this case is very clear that errors were, in fact, made, and it's got to be somebody's fault. It certainly was not the festival's fault. Now, at no time has Parsons asserted that the litigation filed by the festival did not exact a financial toll on the festival. And even if Parsons had not made that concession, the record is clear, particularly at pages 2 and 3 of Judge Curry's order, in the series of events that Judge Curry went through, that the festival was in fact impacted. They were forced to file a lawsuit. They appeared before Judge Curry twice to get temporary restraining orders or other injunctive relief. And they were forced to post the bond of $460,000 in order to put 25,000 gallons per day of wastewater into the town system. The restatement, section 914, discusses two types of harm that can be suffered and for which compensation can be received by a plaintiff such as the festival. First, fees and costs incurred, and second, reasonable compensation for loss of time. The record that was presented to the trial court and to the Court of Appeals is abundantly clear that given the magnitude of the demand that was authored by Parsons and then tendered by the town, that the festival was put in the position of having to take expensive action. So the only reasonable conclusion that can be drawn based upon what was presented to the trial court and what the Court of Appeals reviewed was not only was Parsons a cause of the loss, but more likely than not, the only cause of the loss.
Counsel, can I just get you to back up? So did you end up bringing suit against Parsons? And can you?
We brought suit against, we first sued the town.
Okay, and Parsons was not a party to that.
Parsons was not a party to that. Parsons at that time was the independent contractor and engineer for the town. And initially, Parsons was named as the expert witness for the town. About 8 months after that, after significant briefing, and after we sued Parsons, Parsons was terminated as both the expert witness and also as the independent contractor for the town for certain duties.
Okay, so later you did sue Parsons.
We did sue Parsons.
And what happened with that lawsuit?
It is this case, just.
Right.
Yes.
But I mean, I'm sorry, what happened to the determination of liability on that?
The determination of liability was made by Judge King, and what Judge King determined is he said there is a duty that's owed from Parsons to the festival. Okay. But the festival was not damaged by the actions of Parsons. Judge King also found that there was no breach of the duty. Okay. So he didn't discuss in any sort of depth or actually at all why he found that there was no breach of a duty. All he discussed was the lack of damages. And based upon that fact, it seems clear to me that Judge King kind of backed into his ultimate conclusion that there was no breach of duty. His position appears to be, unless you can show some harm, there's no breach of the duty that occurred. It goes up to the Court of Appeals at that juncture. And the Court of Appeals finds on the issues that are presented to this court that the festival had an obligation to present precise evidence to the effect that it was more expensive to prosecute a case where the stakes were $1.6 million versus a case ultimately with roughly $95,000. And the reduction from the 1.6 to the $95,000, or to be fair, the reduction of the water claim from $600,000 to $95,000 did not occur until after Parsons had been terminated. And by that time, you know, the horse had left the barn from a financial standpoint, significant time. And, you know, I can't stand here today and tell you what the festival would have done if they had been presented with a demand of $95,000 versus $1.6 million. But the case certainly would have taken a different course of action. And the reality is that even after the new expert witness was retained, the case was still roughly a $700,000 case. Now, the new expert witness came way off of the number on the wastewater, which is really what's at issue in this case, okay? And he came off a little bit as it relates to the water. But at the end of the day, and what this court, I think, should determine is that the issue of damages was not presented at the summary judgment level. There were basically three positions that the...
Mr. Rice?
Yes?
Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
Yes, sir, Justice.
I'm having a lot of confusion here.
Sure.
It seems like Court of Appeals treated this as two separate causes of action. First being the tort of wrong of another.
Yes.
And the second being negligence. Right? I mean, yes. How they dealt with it. Yeah, I'm not talking about the
right.
result.
Right.
So the first question I have, I'm just confused. I'm confused because in your complaint, you argue breach of contract, breach of implied duty, fair dealing, and the negligence.
Right.
And then in Judge King's order, there's no breach of contract, therefore there's no tort. He doesn't say tort. He said there's no wrong for another for a breach of contract.
Right.
So I don't even understand how we get into the wrong for another tort argument.
The wrong of another under Section 914
is a tort, right?
It's an
underlying tort duty, as I understand it. So
right.
You hadn't pled a tort, and there's no finding of a tort on that count. I understand the negligence argument.
Right.
Separate that. So how are we even talking about
the wrong of another under Section 914 of the Restatement of Torts is a remedy which gives rise to damages resulting from tortious conduct
right.
on the part of the defendant. Okay. And that was pled in the complaint.
It's a tort?
It's.
And he found against you?
That's correct.
Because there's no breach of contract?
No, he found there's basically two bases.
He said the wrong of another doctrine does not provide a basis for the plaintiff to assert a contractual claim against the defendants. The plaintiffs were not party, I'm reading. So I'm not
right.
talking about the negligence to damages
right.
business
right.
and the proximate cause. So I don't even understand how are we talking, why are we talking about a tort, the wrong for another, under restatement?
There were two assertions made under the wrong of another. The first was the right to damages arising from the wrong of another arising from an interference with the contractual relationship. The second wrong of another comes under the restatement of torts, and it creates a right to damages in this instance if we can establish that Parsons acted in a negligent fashion. Does that answer your question?
Okay, I understand. Yes, it does.
Okay.
Well, with respect to that one, I thought that Judge King said, "Hey, you didn't prove any damages because the judge said you didn't." Judge Carr, I mean, said neither side could receive attorney's fees, and he also said that there was no breach of
exactly.
duty.
Right.
He said there was a duty, but there's no breach of duty.
Right.
And in Judge Curry's order, he talks it all the time about a lot of things you lost. I forget, you wanted the DNX, the festival grounds from the little town of Larkspur and stuff like that.
Right.
You lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
now, in the context of a wrong of another, I think that it's dangerous to try to mix apples and oranges, okay? Because there was no, there were no tort claims that were brought against the festival by the town. And there were no tort claims that the festival asserted against the town in the underlying action. And if we look at the Brockner case says that Section 914 of the Restatement of Torts does not apply if the other party is at fault. And fault's a tort concept. This is a situation where the festival was forced to sue on two distinct issues. They raised additional issues to go along with that. And on some of the issues they lost, but on the substantial issues, the festival prevailed. And that's on the $1.6 million claim. They also prevailed on the building permit issue. We lost on the deannexation claim. But the only reason that the deannexation claim was brought was as a consequence of the assertion by Parsons that the festival owed $1.6 million, the position was, let's get out of town, you know, so we don't have to pay that. So I don't think that losing on that claim raises the sort of issues that this court contemplated in Brockner, and certainly does not raise the sort of issues that are addressed in the restatement.
This big case of first impression for us. I don't remember, and gosh, heard a lot of tort cases.
I think it is a case of first impression.
We've never adopted it, have we?
The restatement?
The wrong of another.
I think that you have not adopted it, you have embraced it. It was adopted in Brockner, but rejected under those factual circumstances. It was also applied in, I believe, Elijah. So it is a case of first impression from the standpoint of, can a claimant who has lost on certain non-tort claims in an action pursue a claim under Section 914 of the restatement based upon the tortious conduct of the defendant?
You're claiming as damages if you can achieve the elements of what
that is
tort is basically your attorney's fees or pursuing
fees,
the other action?
Our fees and costs in Mr. Paradise's time that was incurred in the litigation involving the town of Larkspur. We are not seeking our fees that are involved in the Parsons case per se. We're seeking nothing more than being made whole, if you will, for having to take action against the town of Larkspur for receiving the demand of $1.6 million in February of 2003.
Definitely successful in that litigation, dramatically so, but the trial court denied your attorney's fees.
As against the town.
Right. Based on what was the reasoning of the court there?
The court did not provide any reasoning. It's a short order that simply says, based upon the record, this court determines that fees are not appropriately awarded as against the town or its counsel.
So I'm still having trouble understanding the suit has publicly exercised your appeal rights against the government. The Parsons was the government representative, basically, right?
Parsons was the independent contractor.
Well, I mean, but they're providing the basis for the government to take the position it did.
Parsons was not a party to the first lawsuit. And the request for attorney's fees in the original case was based upon Rule 11, and it was based upon 13.17.102. Negligence and substantially frivolous are two entirely different concepts from a litigation standpoint. And I think that I don't think that the pursuit of claims as against Parsons now, in light of Judge Curry's order, is inconsistent at all. And the reason why it's not inconsistent is that as a practicing attorney or as a client, you're entitled to rely upon what your expert witness tells you. And in this case, if Parsons is saying, Look, these flows are consistently at 79,000 gallons per day, and it's screwing your system up, and we need to increase the EQRs assessed to the festival. As an attorney and not an engineer, I'm entitled to rely upon that. So the denial of the fees by Judge Curry really have no relevance to our right to seek fees as against Parsons.
It's grasping at the, you know, the implication of this for the professional consulting community, and that they are exposed to an independent action, you know.
What the trial court found, and what the Court of Appeals also found, is that there was a duty that ran from Parsons to the festival. We're suing...
Even though there's no contract there?
Even though there's no contract.
And so what's the source of that duty?
The source of the duty is that Parsons had the reason to believe that the festival would take certain actions based upon certain conclusions made by the town's independent contractor. That is a substantial taxpayer in the town that Parsons knew when it reached certain conclusions that they would impact the festival, and if those conclusions were in error, that the festival could be negatively impacted.
But the duty was actually in consistent with the standards, that kind of stuff.
That is true.
And that occurred to any advice he gave the town, which in turn would run to the citizens of the town.
That's a fair statement, Justice Bender.
And so that was breached here, your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your argument is that he owed a duty to the town to know that $1.6 million was off the boat.
I don't think what's at issue in this, I'll be happy to discuss duty, but the existence of a duty has already been established by both the trial court and sustained by the Court of Appeals. The question is whether or not there is a breach of that duty and whether or not the festival had the obligation to breach the issue of damages or to brief the issue of damages at the Court of Appeals level when it was not raised in the motion for summary judgment.
The way we often think about duty is obviously duty, breach of duty, damages, right?
Right.
And you say duty is established. You say thereafter the trial judge worked backwards. He went to damages, and then he worked his way back into, you say erroneously worked his way back to breach of duty, right?
Right.
And the result of that, and that isn't probably a very good way to look at tort law, but wouldn't the result more or less be the same? Say we even got to duty, breach of duty, but then there are no damages. We'd end kind of at the same place, wouldn't we?
You would end at the same place, and I think that's where the trial court and the Court of Appeals wound up, because the record is so significant in terms of the acknowledged errors that Parsons made. Uh-huh. That if there's a finding of the existence of a duty, which was found, the breach seems clear. The only question is, was that breach the proximate cause of a loss that was suffered by the festival? And for whatever reason, the trial court said, well, Judge Curry said, you know, the festival owes the town $95,000 and each side should pay their own attorney's fees. I don't see how that equates into, I mean, putting aside the fact that it wasn't briefed and it wasn't an issue at the trial court, I mean, I guess I don't see how that equates into a rationalization that the festival did not suffer a loss.
Sure. And maybe you could help us, because I think we're struggling a little bit with what you think should have happened or what you think the result of this case should have been.
Yes, ma'am.
So what do you want our decision to say in the best of all possible worlds?
What I would like for your decision to say is two things. Number one, that both the Court of Appeals and the trial court were erroneous because they predicated their decisions on an issue that was not presented in the motion for summary judgment.
That is damages.
And unless it's, and as a matter of law, unless it's presented, you can't hear it.
Okay, so let's assume that we say that, then what would our next step
then
be?
Then your next step is, because really the only damages that the festival suffered were its fees and costs and loss of time incurred in the initial case, that the Brockner case in restatement section 914 of torts does not stand for the proposition that if there is any finding of wrong on the part of a claimant in the underlying case, that that claimant is not precluded from seeking damages under the restatement. And the rationale for that is
damages in the way of attorney's fees, you mean? Or
just, yes, ma'am.
Okay, so if it had been done correctly, there would have been duty, breach of duty, no damages, but by virtue of duty and breach of duty, attorney's fees.
The attorney's fees are the damages. Yes.
Well, I understand,
yes.
But not
right.
Not compensatory damages or punitive damage, but attorney's fees as a measure of damage in this particular instance.
Yes, ma'am.
And because we sort of skipped the step of breach of duty,
right.
You think we didn't, the lower courts didn't appropriately get to the issue of attorney's fees?
Yes.
Am I summarizing
yes.
that all correctly?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay,
yes.
Thanks. And so what you think should happen is that the case should be remanded for an explicit finding on breach of duty.
The case should be remanded and returned to the trial court.
All the way back. Right,
for either rebriefing of the issue of breach of duty with express instructions that damages or lack of damages were never argued by the defendant Parsons in the original case, and to consider whether or not there's been a finding of breach of duty in the assuming that there are damages.
Okay. Yes, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Unless you have any other questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kirk Mueller on behalf of the Appalese Parsons Corporation and James Miller. I'm going to talk about them together. I'll probably say Jim Miller more often than not, so I don't get tongue-tied. For purposes of this appeal, they are the same. Before I get into the two issues that are certified and some of the issues you've just discussed, an observation or two at the outset. I like what Justice Hobbs said, because my remarks were in that direction anyway. This is not just a case of first impression in Colorado. It's a case of first impression anywhere. This case has been pending for 5 years come July. We've never seen an example in case law or anywhere else where you can do what the festival is trying to do in this case. The festival is trying to get its attorney's fees not from its litigation adversary, it can't because of the American rule, but from its litigation adversary's expert witness and consultant. It's never been done before. Can't find an example anywhere under any theory. The American rule says that, you know, each side pays their own costs unless you have some kind of a Rule 11 violation. In the underlying litigation, the festival protected itself from a frivolous lawsuit by seeking its attorney's fees against the town. At the end of the trial, the judge said no. The festival came back and said, oh, come on, you know, we need to have our fees. This was really outrageous. The town came back and cross-moved for their fees. Judge Curry saw briefing on both sides, saw it go both directions. This was very antagonistic litigation. And when it was all over, one day after the briefing closed, Judge Curry said, no fees here. It's the American rule. This isn't Rule 11 material. Go home. Okay, we're done. Festival is now trying to get the fees from Jim Miller that it couldn't get from its litigation adversary. Do you really want to do that in Colorado? That's the question. I'm going to submit that you don't want to, that parties are protected from frivolous or from vexatious litigation by Rule 11. And if you create a standard or a duty or an avenue somehow so that you can get at your adversary's experts at the end of the litigation, you're going to spawn endless litigation. It's going to vitiate the American rule. I have probably three or four open cases where I've hired expert witnesses. The concern Mr. Hobbs, Justice Hobbs noted, it comes to mind. The first thing they would all do is ask me to indemnify them.
Mr. Miller, could you just explain to me why that your argument that you're making now isn't a lot broader than the issues we granted cert on, which were the things that were ruled on by the courts below? In other words, even if I thought you were making a great argument, isn't that something we shouldn't rule on until it were to, if it were to go back and then come back to us?
Here's what I think. You have the opportunity, I suppose, to change and construe Colorado law under the wrong of another doctrine or the negligence doctrine to do what the festival is asking you to do. I think it's a bad idea. So what I'm suggesting is a policy reason why you don't want to go there. You don't need to go there under the law. Frankly, you would have to change Colorado law in order to get there. So if you'll accept what I'm saying as policy, I'll be glad to tell you why you don't have to do this in any event. All of my experts will ask me to indemnify them for any lawsuit they might get dragged into as a result of my litigation. And so if I have an expert whose opinion is rejected but there's no award of fees, my adversary will sue my expert. I've indemnified him, so I'll be litigating over the issue of fees with my adversary. The whole point of the American rule is we don't want lawyers absent Rule 11 violations to be fighting over who has to pay each other's fees. There are good policy reasons behind it. You guys have articulated it in Allstate versus Lazar, among other cases. There are good reasons why we don't want to battle over attorney's fees after every lawsuit. If you do what the festival is asking you to do, you're inviting that.
If you're finished with that line of question, isn't the easiest way to, I mean, aren't we making this case hard in the sense of looking at it from a policy perspective? Isn't it just an easier way to look at it as to whether the very initial determination as to duty was appropriate or not?
I did not appeal Judge King's finding that a duty existed, although we argued that no duty exists.
All right. So we have in front of us the issue of duty.
Okay. Then let me speak to it.
Please, if you would.
I think what Judge King said was, look, you're the town's water engineer. You have some duty to be competent and not to overbill your customers. You know, you can see that that would be a problem. But as soon as the bill went out, let's say it was too high, litigation ensues. At that point, Jim Miller's duty changes. Now the town is in litigation with a citizen, and he is their expert witness, and he is their consultant, and he has a duty to the town, not to his the town's adversary, but to the town, and that duty is to give him competent support and advice. The town never suggested, not for a second, not through today, that they didn't get good assistance and advice from Judge Jim Miller. They never sued him. The festival urged the town to sue their own witness. They laughed at the festival. They didn't do that. There's never any suggestion by the town that they didn't get just what they wanted, good expert advice. So I would suggest you're on the right track, Your Honor. I don't think there was a breach of the relevant duty in this case.
Well, I understand, and that's why I want to be real careful about distinguishing between whether there was a duty in the first place and whether there was a breach of the duty. And the way the record stands right now, you all are agreeing that he had a independent duty, if you will.
Well, I'm
running from him to the festival.
I'm accepting Judge King's determination that there was a
okay.
duty. And I would, and I did not appeal that.
Sure. And we don't have a decision as to whether that duty, which we all agree, for better or worse now, has been established in this case, was breached, right?
Yes, you do. I would suggest Judge King.
Or we have a back.
Judge King expressly ruled that there was no breach of that duty.
But isn't it correct that he ruled that there was no breach of the duty because there were no damages?
No.
All right. Could you help me with that?
That's a mischaracterization.
Could you help me with that?
Okay. What Judge King says, and you can read his order carefully, he says that there was no breach of the duty because, among other reasons, Judge Curry found that the town, in fact, did owe money to the festival. Judge Curry found that the festival was not entitled to fees. Judge Curry essentially found that the town did not behave wrongfully in its litigation with the festival. If the town did not behave wrongfully, how can Jim Miller have breached any duty, be it to the festival or to the town, in advising them in support of the litigation? Now, the litigation didn't net as much money as they wanted, but it wasn't wrongful.
I beg your pardon. If we go back one step, though, before pre-litigation, I understand that the allegation was that that was where the duty was established and therefore had to have been breached. That is, the bill that went out, what was it, $100,000 too much or whatever it was?
It was $1.6 in total, that's right.
Okay, so that's where the breach of duty, the duty was established and the breach of duty, if it all would have occurred. And then he took on this kind of different role, maybe, maybe not, but the allegation is that that's where the duty was breached. And then the allegation is because of this breach of duty, they had to sue you, and It got reduced, which it should have, but they incurred attorney's fees along the line, and that's their damage.
You're right about all of that, yes.
Okay. So why shouldn't, in that kind of a situation, you know, there be this sort of a tort? It seems to be what's being contemplated by the restatement.
Well...
And I don't mean to oversimplify.
Sure. The tort can exist, but you can't have a breach of the duty, I would submit, Justice Rice. He initially issued a bill for $1.6 million and then supported the litigation to try to collect $1.6 million. And Judge Curry said that that litigation to collect $1.6 million was perfectly okay. It wasn't, at the end of the day, successful, but it wasn't Rule 11 fee-shifting kind of litigation. So in good faith, they sought $1.6 million. So if Mr. Miller's duty was to be competent when he issued a bill for $1.6 million and litigation ultimately didn't net that but was not wrongful litigation, how can you say that what Jim Miller did was not competent? It seems to me the litmus test for whether the town's position is actionable for purposes of attorney's fees is precisely the motion they filed with Judge Curry to get their fees.
Isn't, though, the nature of this tort, not that the town breached a duty to the festival, but rather that the festival suffered as a result of your client breaching a duty to the town.
That is the nature of the, that is the nature.
And
of the
you tort. Don't seem to be disputing that, you know, we should have such a tort or should recognize it, but you seem to be saying, but if the way in which the festival suffered was by having to litigate, which they wouldn't otherwise have had to do, they shouldn't be allowed to recover for that. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, Justice Coates, the last part, just a moment, say it again.
Well, it seemed to me that what your argument is that if the way in which the festival suffered was that they had to pay the costs, the fees, suffer the expenses of litigation that they wouldn't have otherwise had to go through, but for your client's wrong, you seem to be wanting to say, well, that's just not the kind of damages, though, that we should allow under this tort. Is that right?
No, I agree with you that they would be entitled under that scenario to recover their fees. There has to be wrong.
But isn't that what this tort suit is about, is whether your client breached a duty to the town and then whether Rocky Mountain suffered?
That's absolutely right. And I'm saying that there was no breach of the duty to the town in the first instance, because...
But that's why I think it feels circular, at least to me, and which is, you so that it's circular because there seems to be this sort of argument, well, there were no damages, therefore there was no breach. And that's why I think that whole linear approach to tort law is so helpful, at least for me.
There are no damages is a red herring.
Well...
Justice okay. Rice, that nobody has ever said that the festival didn't incur attorney's fees.
Sure. I mean, we know a few things. They had to sue you. They won. They didn't get attorney's fees from you. They now are taking the position that they should be getting attorney's fees from your engineer because he's the one who caused all the problems in the first place.
Yeah. There are a few things that I would correct about that. First of all, they didn't win on everything. They won on some issues. They lost on others.
Okay.
They can say they had to sue us. I don't agree with that either.
Well, they wouldn't have gotten any relief had they not.
Well, who knows?
Really? Who knows?
Yeah.
I think they would have gotten relief if they just called up and said, please, will you reduce this?
Yeah, there was a lot of antagonism between the parties. You know, we have to accept the record as
okay,
is, because this
agree.
Was summary judgment. Let me step through the wrong of another doctrine and see if we can kind of address this, as you say, from the top down.
Yeah, I like that.
First of all, the only kind of party who can bring a wrong of another claim has to be without fault. You know, Mr. Rice wants to go off and talk about fault being a negligence concept and so forth. I don't think that's what fault means in Brockner and in the restatement. Fault means you can't have precipitated the litigation that you're complaining about by your own action. It has to be thrust on you by some third party. Okay, that's not the situation here. Here, for one thing, the festival actually did owe money to the town and hadn't paid it. Here, the festival brought several claims and lost on several of them at trial. So the festival is at least in part to blame for the fact that the festival is in litigation. Okay, it owed money and didn't pay it. Well, we didn't know as much as they said. Okay, so the town's partly to blame. But so are you. You owe money. Pay up. Well, you know, you want $1.6 million, we're not paying. You can't here say that you are blameless. But you, the town's involved here. Jim Miller didn't do this all by himself. He's a town engineer. There's a town attorney, a town council, there's a mayor. Lots of people made the decision to file this lawsuit. Brockner and restatement say where you are completely blameless and you get thrust into litigation by the wrong of another, then maybe then you go to that other and say, look, I had to get in this big lawsuit. It's all because of you. You got to pay my fees. Classic example is the Elijah case. It's a quiet title action. The broker violates his duty to the purchaser. Purchaser buys property that has a lien on it. He doesn't know it. Purchaser has to have quiet title litigation with a third party to quiet title. Then he sues the broker and says, it's all your fault. Broker's another party. Look what's happening in this case. Jim Miller is not another party. He is the town. He's the town's engineer. He's part of the litigation group. He was the designated expert witness. And they're peeling him off and saying, you're another. You caused us to get involved in this lawsuit. This is not a wrong of another kind of tort at all. This is just a way of going at your adversary and picking one person out of the team and saying, you're another. You passed the deciding vote on the town council. It's all your fault that I got sued. So this isn't a proper wrong of another case at all, I would argue.
And you're saying that, if I'm hearing you now, the reason it's not a proper wrong of another is because he really doesn't have any kind of independent duty.
I would contend he doesn't, certainly once litigation starts.
Okay. That's right. Then you'd say even still it's not breached. Just a mistake.
Well, both sides were a little bit wrong. Neither side violated Rule 11. Do you want to start handing out fees to parties who haven't violated Rule 11? Again, in that rare circumstance where the broker doesn't tell the purchaser that there's a cloud on the property and purchaser has to get in third-party litigation, maybe there. But really, do you want to do it in a situation like this? Why not peel off the mayor and say, you're another. You know, you led these guys down the wrong track. I want to sue you for involving me in litigation with the town. And one last thought. The wrong here, not only is Jim not another, the wrong here is the same wrong. When you read what the festival said in its petition for fees to Judge Curry, all the things the town did wrong and why they ought to have their fees, it's the same thing they're saying about Jim Miller. Your charge is too much. 1.6 is more. You should have known better. They said that as to the town. And Judge Curry said, no. You know, it's good faith. It might not have been entirely right, but it's good faith. Get out of here. So that same wrong they're trying to tag Jim Miller with. So it's the same wrong. In a wrong of another suit, again, Elijah, broker has a fiduciary duty to purchaser. Broker violates that duty, purchaser's in a lawsuit with another party. That is not this case. This case is not a wrong of another case at the end of the day. Now, you can do this. I mean, you can go there, I think. You know, you can construe Colorado law. You can read Brockner broadly. You can say that you don't have to be wholly blameless, you can be partially blameless, and then you can get in there on that one claim where you were right, and you can try to get your fees. But back to my policy argument, you're going to spawn a lot of litigation. It's the kind of litigation that is the precise reason why we have the American rule. In the Allstate case, you guys articulated that one of the reasons you don't want to have attorney's fees, except in rare circumstances, is because of the burden on judicial administration to try to litigate what's a reasonable fee. And so for the most part, you don't do this. And exceptions to that rule are narrow. You have a bright line exception now. If you're completely blameless for getting dragged into litigation, then you can go and try to get your fees from somebody. And it's easy then, because all your fees are recoverable, assuming they're reasonable. Here we have a lawsuit that went on for 3 years. Jim Miller was involved for 1 year, and then he got replaced. 5-6 different issues. How are you going to figure out what part of that, including Mr. Paradise's time, you know, can really be peeled off and paid for by Jim Miller? And how are you going to make 6 citizens in Douglas County listen to all of this? I mean, you can go there, but I would suggest it's not a good way to go.
Even if we would like to find there's no duty or there was no breach of duty, are we sort of playing beyond that now? Do we have those kind of findings which have not been appealed and are not before us?
I think that you can, sua sponte, take up the issue of duty, if you are so inclined. Breach has been decided. Judge King said there is no breach of duty because there was no Rule 11 violation here. How can Jim Miller have been negligent counseling the town if what the town did was not wrongful?
But Rule 11, doesn't that go to whether the town violated a duty? But did Judge King make a finding then that your client didn't breach a duty as a by finding that there was no Rule 11 violation?
That is, I think, exactly what he found. And I think the reasoning, when you think about it, stands up. How can Jim Miller have breached a duty by encouraging the town to pursue litigation that was perfectly righteous litigation? It didn't prevail, but it was lawful. It wasn't wrongful. He's their litigation consultant and their expert witness. And he said, you know, here's the theory. And they tried the theory, and they didn't get all that they wanted, but they got some, and they did not violate Rule 11.
You know, there's a difference between willful or frivolous and just negligence, right?
Well, we've cited cases in the briefs below to Judge King, and there's one in our brief to you that says the Rule 11 standard is akin to negligence. It's essentially a negligence standard. It's negligence for professional lawyers. But all the way up to the Supreme Court, there are statements that say Rule 11 is akin to a negligence standard. If you accept, however, Judge Bender, even if you accept that there is a difference, again, I think the way you have to analyze it is Jim Miller is counseling the town as to what it can do and should do in the litigation. And what the town did was not wrongful. It's that negligent. I mean, don't lawyers all do whatever they can within the bounds of Rule 11 in the interests of their client? We all do. That's what it's there for. We don't go beyond it, and the town didn't go beyond it. So how can you say that Jim was negligent? And this is accepting, you know, the moonshine that all of this is Jim, that he's the guiding force behind, you know, Scotty Crobb is the town attorney, he's a former judge, he's a wonderful lawyer. A lot of people made this decision, but assuming it was all Jim. Still, what the town did was not wrongful. How can he have been negligent counseling the town?
Counsel, while you're looking through there, can I just ask you, do you believe that we've actually adopted the wrong of another tort in Colorado?
You've talked about it and how it applies and doesn't apply in at least a couple of cases. Elijah is one, Rockner is another. I don't know that I can say for sure that you've adopted it. I can't say that you've rejected it either. I think it's an open question.
We've talked about it.
You've discussed it.
And we have discussed it. Okay.
As I recall, in Elijah, you basically allowed the purchaser to recover against the broker under the theory that was wrong of another theory. Purchaser was wholly innocent. It wasn't the purchaser's fault that the broker breached the duty and gave them a cloudy title. So I think you have adopted it to that extent. And I think your adoption has been premised on the very narrow exception that only where the fee-seeking party in the position of the festival has done nothing to bring the litigation on themselves.
Thank you.
Your Honors, to get where the festival wants to go, basically in this case, you know, you've got to do a number of things that just at each step they're bad idea and they're contrary to the way that we do business in this state. You would have to adopt sort of a relative blame standard for the wrong of another. You let the festival come in and say, well, you know, we were wrong, we owed money, and we had some theories that were, you know, our own theories, and we lost on those. But boy, there's this one issue where we really think we can single out Jim Miller and he's the villain, and as to that, whatever part of our fees we can allocate to that, we should be able to recover. That's what you would have to do. You make Brockner relative. Brockner says as long as you're without blame, then you can bring a wrong of another. And what festival says is, well, as long as you're not you're without blame as to one issue, then maybe you can go with it. That would be a change in the way you view the wrong of another in this state. I think it's a bad idea because you open floodgates, but you would have to do that for starters. Then you would have to get past the fact that Jim Miller isn't really another, and that the wrong complained of is the same wrong as the one committed by the town. It's not a proper context for a wrong of another, but you would have to do that. You have to forgive the festival for not, in the negligence count, not adequately responding to the negligence arguments that we put forth in our summary judgment motion, and give them a second day in court on that to try to correct or try to go back to Judge King and convince him, yes, there really was a breach, and yes, we really were damaged by what Jim Miller did. They didn't do that the first time, but they would have another day in court to do that. And then finally, you would have to say that you can bring a negligence claim against your adversary's expert witness. There's a lot of hurdles to jump. And, you know, where you end up with, once you've done all of that, is with every expert consultant exposed to the risk of being sued because he has apparently some obligation that's different vis-a-vis the adversary than he has to his own client that he's counseling in litigation. Okay, one last item, and I'll yield the podium. The festival would have you believe that they got sandbagged by Judge King and the Court of Appeals because they were forced to, quote-unquote, prove up damages when damages were not challenged in the summary judgment brief. It's not what happened. You have to read the briefing below. Jim Miller argued that he was not the proximate cause of the damages they complained of because he is not a member of the town council, he's not a lawyer, he doesn't vote, he was simply a consultant. The name on the pleading is the town's and not his. He wasn't the proximate cause. He was removed after 1 year. That litigation went on for 3 years. After 1 year, he was removed and a new consultant came on. And they went for two more years, they went all the way through trial, and two appeals were filed. He says, I am not the proximate cause as a matter of law under these circumstances of these alleged damages. Festival came back, and under Rule 56, they were obligated to plead specific facts, not just rest on the pleadings and general allegations, but plead specific facts and say, yes, yes, you were the proximate cause. They didn't do that. What they said was, well, for the first year, we had to defend against a claim for $1.6 million. And holy cow, that was expensive, and at the end of the day, it was less. That was their only defense. Court of Appeals, they put a little bit more skin on it. In the Court of Appeals, they said, you know, quoting their brief, as a matter of common sense, no intelligent person could reasonably dispute that the level of attention and expense devoted to a $1.6 million claim would be significantly greater. So their idea of responding to specific factual allegations under Rule 56 is to say, as a matter of common sense, no intelligent person could reasonably dispute. Court of Appeals says that's good, not good enough, quoting the court. Festival fails to allege any facts to support its contention and relies solely on unfounded assumptions. So when they say that they were sandbagged, that they were forced to prove up damages, that's not really why damages came into play. They brought the damage component in an effort to refute the argument that Jim Miller was the proximate cause of their injuries. They didn't do that adequately. The trial court found that they didn't. The Court of Appeals found that they didn't. So to suggest that they didn't have the day in court on the issue of negligence just is a rewrite of history. It's not the way it went. Your Honors, I'm through unless you have questions.
Yeah, I'm not going to let you sit down. Just one more. Yeah. So what is the duty? I mean, back to duty, but what is the duty that Miller and Parsons owes the festival under Colorado law as you read it?
I don't disagree with Judge King. He said failure to act in a competent and professional manner.
But that's not, I guess I'm trying to get more into the third party beneficiary line of reasoning. I mean, there obviously there's a relationship between Parsons and the town, but there's no contractual relationship between Parsons and the festival. So what would that duty look like under Colorado law in your view? Not the duty that Parsons owns the town.
Okay. I mean, I would say any public servant owes a duty to be competent professional. There are cases, we cited these a lot in our underlying briefs that kind of got lost on the appeal, that talk about whether you can, you know, you have a duty that runs to the public when you're out, you know, building a bridge and you're a consultant to the town. And they basically say that, you know, citizens don't have independent action against the consultant for the municipality who builds the bridge and it fails. They have a claim against the town. The town has a claim against the consultant. I would think that is the nature of the duty.
So So you're saying there is no duty between Parsons and the festival based on those cases?
I would say that the town cannot sue the consultant directly. That's right. There is no duty based on those. Again, that got lost in the briefing as it evolved. And I am, you know, constrained to some extent by Judge King, who says there is this duty. I would, again, come back to the notion that, and there's plenty of case law for this, an expert witness has no obligation to his client's adversary. There's no obligation there, and frankly, that would be a conflict. And certainly once litigation arises and Jim Miller is in the litigation side of the table, to say he has an obligation that's different than the town's, which is Rule 11, vis-a-vis the adversary, certainly there's no duty like that.
Thank you.
Your Honors, there's a good reason why there's no case like this out there. This is a bad idea. Thank you.
Do not be fooled. Before this lawsuit was filed, the festival, Parsons, and the town were all supposed to be on the same team. Parsons was acting as an independent contractor, as a public servant that had a duty to the festival. We are not suing Parsons because they acted in the course of litigation for the benefit of the town. At the time that the mistake was made, the town and the festival were not adversaries. It was the mistake that put the litigation ball in motion that we are seeking compensation for. In terms of the wrong of another, I think what this court needs to look at in the context of Brockner and in terms of blame is how was the litigation cast at the outset? And in this instance, the litigation was cast this way. Based upon Mr. Miller's opinion, the town said, Festival, you owe us $1.6 million for water and wastewater fees, and if you don't pony up that, we're going to cut off your water and you're going to be out of business. That's the way it was cast. There was never a demand made at the beginning or before the litigation was filed. Festival, we think you owe us $95,000 for water. You owe us $600,000 for water and $1 million for wastewater services under a model that Mr. Miller put together as the town engineer, an independent contractor by contract. By contract. That's the way the litigation was cast. How are we to be blamed for pursuing litigation under those circumstances? We were right. Now, if they had made a demand for us to pay $95,000 before we're a year and a half down the road, then that's a whole different discussion. But that's not the way, that's not what triggered this lawsuit.
Were you ever given a bill for something less? I mean, you just, maybe you didn't actually get a bill, but did you get a bill for $1.6 million and you said, we're not going to pay any portion of that, and then you sued them? Is that how that worked?
Basically, we got the bill for $1.6 million. We attempted to discuss the matter with the town. The town was financially strapped. They had no desire to try to whittle back from the 1.6. It was not reduced from 1.6 to $95,000 until after Mr. Miller and Parsons were terminated as independent contractors and town engineers that discussion came up.
Well, they say you share in the fault, and I guess, or the blame, and that your share is that you didn't pay something. You knew you owed something for water. You were using it, and you didn't pay anything. What would you say to that?
If they had presented us with a bill that had some rational basis, we should have considered it. Let's distinguish between water usage and EQRs, okay? EQRs can only be assessed under a certain set of circumstances, okay? In this instance, the town took an all-or-nothing proposition and didn't back down from that until the litigation was well underway. We were never presented with a bill for $95,000. The only way we found out about the $95,000 was through discovery with Wayne Lawrence, who is the new expert witness for the town.
Can I ask one question about about this Rule 11 sort of argument?
Sure.
Is your ability to recover here entirely dependent upon the, let's call it, fortuity that the advice came from someone who was an independent expert who advised the town? Had it been the town itself that made this mistake or behaved in this way, made this bad determination, and you sued the town and you won part and you lost part, but you got your fees denied because they didn't act badly enough to have to pay fees, there would be no one else to go after. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. But here's what I think this panel needs to keep in mind is that when one executes a contract as an independent contractor, you got to take the good with the bad, okay? If Parsons wanted to align itself under the town's umbrella and under the Rule 11 umbrella and under the umbrella that says, look, here's the American rule, you can't get your fees out of it, okay? then they should have signed a contract that did not make them an independent contractor. Right? There's benefits to being an independent contractor, and there's some downsides. But you can't say, well, geez, you know, now we've enjoyed the downsides, the upsides of being an independent contractor, but now we want to be protected by the town because of a determination under Rule 11 and 1317.102. They bit that off. And in fact, the contract calls for an obligation on the part of Parsons to indemnify the town for any losses the town might suffer. There is no reason why Parsons cannot and does not have an independent duty to the festival, and there's no reason why Parsons should be protected by the determination of Judge Curry as to whether or not the litigation was frivolous. The reason the litigation wasn't frivolous is because they believed that Mr. Miller knew what he was doing, and he didn't. And that resulted in a lawsuit, a very expensive lawsuit. All the discussion by counsel that he's not going to be able to retain expert witnesses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that's inapplicable, completely inapplicable. We're talking about somebody who is doing a job, not as an adversary, but a job consisting of a duty that they were charged to do correctly, expressly, and they didn't do it. They didn't do it. And it cost everybody a bunch of time, money, and effort. And in terms of not outlining specifically what the breaches were on the part of Parsons, I'd respectfully suggest that this court look very carefully at our reply brief in this case, with citations to the record at the trial court that indicated that the demand was authored by Parsons. Parsons, the one that encouraged the town to aggressively pursue action as against the festival. It was Parsons that modeled this entire EQ hour. The town had no input on it at all, other than it's presented to the town, and Mr. Miller says, here's my conclusions, and here's what I think you ought to do. And those were wrong. I mean, not just a little bit wrong, but radically wrong. If you look at Judge Curry's order, he points out there was no basis for the conclusion specifically as it relates to wastewater based upon flows. I mean, his measurement of flows were wrong. And we're stuck with, you know, $300,000 in expert fees, in attorney's fees. And remember, the concern that counsel has about the ability to segregate out these fees is covered in the AWDI case.
I missed something here. Did you ask for costs when you beat back the city that far?
Excuse me?
You got your costs, your expert fees?
No, sir, because it's a municipality, and absent a specific contractual provision or a municipality being willing to absorb that, we could not. So we got nothing.
So you got to go against the expert to get those costs?
Not the expert, the independent contractor. He didn't become an expert until after the litigation was filed to justify what he did previously. My time is up. Thank you very much.
I want to thank both counsel for your arguments.